with Jerry Leary on our Blind Like Me show today. Jerry, how are you today?
I'm pretty darn good.
Pretty darn good. Well, that's about good as it gets in Colorado. And you're in Colorado?
Yes, I am in Colorado, and that's about as good as it gets. I'm doing fine.
Hang on just a sec. Okay. And I was giving Don a little CD here that he's going to run on the radio. Now, what city in Colorado are you in?
I live in Boulder, Colorado.
Well, that's a big town. That's how many people? At least a million, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know the exact amount of figures, but anymore it's just another suburb of Denver.
Yeah, I guess everything in Colorado is another suburb of Denver, I suppose.
Well, at least everything over on this side.
And how long have you been there?
Since 1979.
But you weren't born there. This isn't your hometown.
No, I was born in Illinois, grew up in California, and came here came to Central City in 77, and then moved down here in 79.
So you've been a number of places, haven't you?
Yep.
What is your level of vision?
I have zero. I've never seen a thing in my life.
Oh, you were born this way?
Yeah.
Well, that's two of us. I was too. I was born a total. And you were born in Illinois in what year?
1952.
52.
I was one of the over-oxygenated babies, so my retina's burnt.
Mm-hmm. So you're early 50s. You're 51.
Yep.
And you've been dealing with this blind thing all your life, haven't you?
Yep.
Yep. Tell us about your childhood, if you don't mind. Did you go to public school?
Well, I went to public school for the, it was a school for blind people. It wasn't boarding school. It was regular bus you in and out for the first six grades.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to a normal middle school and high school that had programs for the blind. So there were about 10 blind students in each of those schools. And then I got about halfway through a business administration major in college, and in high school I had started drag racing with a friend of mine, so I started working at gas stations and such so we could support the race car.
Now, in your early years, this was a public school set up for blind children.
For my first six grades, yes. It was like a normal grade school, but it was set up for blind kids.
What a wonderful concept. I wonder if anyone, I guess they're still doing that somewhere.
They may be. They've been, when I was on my way out of high school, I still knew the principal of that school, and they were really trying to mainstream most of the kids at that point. That was in the late 60s, early 70s. They were trying to stop that one school that was just for blind people and turn it more into a mainstream situation.
And this school was just for blind people. I mean, there were no sighted peers. There were no sighted kids around. Just blind people.
No, there was a school next door to us that was all sighted kids, but
okay.
They weren't affiliated.
Okay, but you didn't get to play together on the playground with these sighted kids, and your contact with them was somewhat limited by the schools, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, that's no good. I agree with the principal. You need to have involvement with blind children and sighted children to get, you know, to get a balance. And this was for your first sixth grades, and they began teaching you Braille.
Yeah, they began by teaching us Braille. We had all the normal, you know, history and math lessons. The only differences were in mathematics, they taught us how to add and subtract from left to right so that we didn't need to use paper to work the numbers.
Yeah, how did you write numbers? I mean, did you write them in Braille, or you have a number for them?
We wrote them in Braille. They just didn't want us using it as scrap paper because they said the paper was too expensive back then.
Yeah, I guess it was. Maybe they were worried about trees. We don't seem to be worried about that now, do we?
Yeah, I don't think they were worried as much about trees, but I think in the mid-50s, from what I remember, Braille paper was between 5 and 10 cents a sheet.
Whoa.
Which isn't that bad today, but back then, 10 cents a sheet when you could buy a ream of print paper for 39 cents was a lot of money.
Yeah, I guess it's thicker, and you wouldn't have much use for it unless you were writing Braille on it. There'd be no reason to make it, would there?
Yeah.
I never had thought about that. I don't know what Braille. I have no idea what Braille paper sells for today. I guess someone can tell us.
I'm not exactly sure myself.
All right, so they had you do math. They taught you history. But and how many students were, how many blind kids were here?
I think there was about 100 of us.
Yeah, and you were in dormitories? You were with them?
We were bused all over the L.A. area into the school. I used to ride the bus for about 2 hours every day.
So you lived at home?
Yes.
Oh, man, that's a tremendous advantage.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, so this was for L.A. kids.
Yes.
And you rode the bus 2 hours. Of course, a sighted kid might have the same deal, depending on what school they went to. So you
especially in the early 60s when they started desegregating.
Yeah, a lot of kids rode buses. So you caught the bus, I guess, about 5:30 in the morning.
I caught the bus at 6:05, and we had to be there by a little after 8 or so. And then at 3, I'd catch the, well, for a while it was 2:15, and then it went to 3 o'clock, then I would catch the bus home.
But they trusted little Jerry to do this on his own, little blind child, to handle this on his own, this bus trip.
My folks were up with me in the morning.
Well, yeah, but they put you on the bus.
Yeah, they put me on the bus, and away I went.
Well, that's a learning experience in and of itself.
I have to say the bus rides were interesting. There were, the bus that I rode picked up about anywhere from 12 to 16 kids, I think, depending on what year it was.
Yeah.
So there was always the same kids on the bus throughout my first 6 years of school.
And they were sighted kids also?
No, they were all blind kids.
Oh, this bus was just a blind bus?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I thought they stuck you on the regular school bus.
No, this was just the school bus for the particular school that I was going to.
Mm-hmm.
And, I knew pretty much all the same kids throughout the time. Of course, there's a few of the kids that came and went from moving and such.
Yeah, and then the kids would decide to be mainstream or maybe decide to go to a closed blind school or a blind school where you stayed.
Yeah, usually it was a case of, well, my dad got transferred, so I have to move.
So I have to move, yeah. So you knew the same kids. And from year to year, and you'd see them in May, and then you'd do the summer, and you'd see them again in September, and you knew the same, just like we did. We knew this, you get back, and the same kids are gonna be there. Now, this was for your first 6th grades, and I assume you did well in these 6th grades, and then they did what with you, you said?
Well, then I went to a normal junior high and high school that had a program for blind students in the school, and what they would do is they'd have a resource room where there was a teacher and all of our books that they could get.
Uh-huh.
And the teacher's main job was to help us integrate into the class. So when we had a test, we'd take it back there, and a teacher or one of the assistants would read it to us, or some of the faculty would get them the tests early so they could get it in Braille.
Uh-huh.
And then we could read it ourselves and write the answers on a slate and stylus or a Braille writer and type the paper later. Sometimes they would get the tests, and test times we'd go back to what we called the Braille room.
Okay.
And one of the teacher's assistants would read it to us, and we would type the answers and then bring it back to class.
I like that term, the Braille room.
That's what we called it. I don't know what the actual room for, the actual name for it was.
Yeah, but that's such a great blind thing, the Braille room.
Yeah.
So they tried their best to basically kind of mainstream you because you were around some sighted children then, and they were all those sighted people were all over the place, weren't they? Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I'll tell you, the first day that I spent, I remember going to what they called a orientation. I got to go to the junior high school the semester before and just go there for, well, I don't know how long it was, probably a few hours.
Uh-huh.
Get taken around to a couple classrooms and eat a lunch at the cafeteria. And I came from, like I said, a grade school that had about 100 people to a middle school that had 1,500.
Just, and it was overwhelming.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
I'll never forget that first day. Because I was saying things like, I'll never meet everybody. Of course, that's true, but...
But who'd want to? You know, you didn't need to.
No, but to me, I felt that because I knew most of the people in the school that I was going to,
uh-huh.
I sort of felt like, isn't that what you do? You know most of the people. And that's, you know, at that point in time, my folks said, you'll never know all the people there. You can't.
But you did make some friends.
I made a lot of friends.
Yeah, I would imagine so. And most blind kids do that work at it. We have kids in our school here that do, and some who don't. But those who work at it and whose parents allow them to do fine. I mean, make sighted friends.
I had. Once I got into middle school, I knew more people because they lived in my local area. The school was only about 4 miles from the house.
Yeah, their parents knew your... Yeah,
so,
okay.
You know, I knew kids from down the street.
Yeah, and that made it a whole lot better, didn't it? Once you got over the fact that there were 1,500 of them.
Yeah, I mean, I also had to get used to not being bused for 2 hours, which was great.
Well, yeah, which was much better. You got to sleep till 6:30.
Oh, yeah.
Did you have siblings? Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I had three brothers and a sister.
Like, you got to sleep late like they did, see?
Yep.
Which was a good thing. All right, and this was middle school and high school, and you did well. You passed every grade and...
Well, I had to take algebra twice.
Well, doesn't everybody?
Some do.
I never got that far. I wouldn't know, but a lot of people have trouble with algebra. My grandchildren had immense problems when they first started doing algebra. But basically, you did fine. Now, with you're getting to this hot rod thing. You started that when?
Well, I started that in high school. A school buddy of mine wanted to do drag racing, and so did I. And so we just started working together at it. And my father was a mechanic, and I had started learning car stuff as a child.
Okay.
And he really didn't want me to go into that. He really didn't want me to be out in the garage playing around with cars.
Wonder why?
Because he didn't like it that well, and I think also he thought that I should do more of an intellectual craft.
Yeah.
And I could have been right, but I stuck with cars. I ended up being a professional mechanic until... a couple of years ago.
Well, I want to get into that, but let's talk about this drag racing. So you were, of course, the shotgun man.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't ride in the car because you get to a point in drag racing, they'll let a car go a certain speed before, and then any faster, you can't take a passenger.
Yeah. So these were rails. I mean, these were long, thin cars.
No, this was regular cars.
Okay.
But the whole thing was modified a lot. They called it, back then they called it Pro Stock.
And there was a track there in you were still in L.A.
Yeah,
I'm sure there was
in L.A. There were several tracks around the area.
That would allow folks to race. And this was an engine, a stock engine that you folks had modified?
These were all cars that you... Part of the ruling was it had to be a car that you could go out and buy, so it had to be what they called a stock-type car.
Okay.
But you could make various and sundry modifications to make it faster. And there were things you could and couldn't do, and if you wanted to do other things, of course, you had to race in other classes.
Okay.
For the type of class that we were in, you know, there were certain things we could do and certain things we couldn't.
And so you were constantly looking for things you could do to make this car milliseconds faster.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you were the mechanic. Was your buddy a mechanic that did the racing? Or?
We both were.
You both were.
We both worked on it. And then he drove it. Of course, when he was, you know, driving, I would be just sitting around someplace with a bunch of our other buddies.
Yeah.
Around drinking beer.
Well, I can't imagine that.
Oh, yeah, that's how you fuel yourself at racetrack.
I know it. And you know, I, regardless of what your father think, I think this is a wonderful experience for a young blind child to get hands-on training and learn how internal combustion engines work and learn what a torque wrench is and learn, because I didn't learn all these things so much later in life. I think a great, you know, a great experience. Of course, I never did want to be a mechanic, but then obviously you did and worked at one, right? Worked at
yeah.
one. All right, let's get into that in just a second. Let me take just a short break and run a little commercial or two, and we'll be back with more of the Blind Like Me show with Jerry Leary in just a sec.
About blind folk, information you'll probably never need. Titillating tidbits to make you think on the blind side. Here's Don Patterson.
And although I haven't read it, it sounds very interesting. The title of the book is called Art Beyond Sight. The book, Beyond Art Beyond Sight, is a resource guide to art, creativity, and visual impairment. It was developed by the Art Education for the Blind, Incorporated, and co-published by AEB and the American Foundation for the Blind, which provided insight, information, and instruction on how people who are blind or visually impaired not only appreciate art, but also how they can create it. Art Beyond Sight began as a teaching manual, but it soon evolved into a broader, far-reaching publication that can be read and enjoyed by educators, museum professionals, blind or visually impaired people themselves, their families, and friends. Art Beyond Sight includes reproduction of works of art by blind or visually impaired artists, and a section of personal perspectives from those artists and from parents and teachers of visually impaired children. The book is available in print and as an accessible ASCII file for computers. It was probably the fundamental belief of Art Education for the Blind that led to the publication of Art Beyond Sight. This belief is that if people are blind and visually impaired are to participate in the world, they must have access to the world's visual culture. I wholeheartedly agree. I'll see you down at the bookstore. On the Blind Side, I'm Don Patterson.
On the Blind Side, answering questions nobody asks.
Continuing with Jerry Leary from Boulder, did you say? Boulder.
Yes. Yeah,
Boulder, Colorado. And Jerry, as we've got him in high school, and he's a mechanic, and we're working on, what do they call them? They call them modified
stock cars.
Modified stock cars. And did your friend and the car that you, I guess you had a car that belonged to both of you that was a communally owned.
Well, it was owned by him, but we both worked on it together. What it was an old 66 Ford Ranchero, which is basically a Ranchero was a car that looked like a car, but it had a pickup bed on the back.
I know, I've seen them. I know exactly what you're talking about.
So it was about the size of a normal station wagon.
Yeah.
And he had driven it during his high school years, and right as when he got to be a senior in high school, we decided to race it.
Okay.
And so there were a few weeks here and there where it didn't go to school because we had broken something, and it took us a while to get it fixed. We both had jobs to try and support it.
Now, your job, you say you were working at a service station?
I was working at a service station doing minor car repairs.
All right. Did you pump some gas also, or did
a little bit, but they didn't want me to deal with the money.
Yeah, because you couldn't see, and somebody could shortchange you.
Yeah.
And would. And would.
They might. I never really got, in the time that I was a car mechanic, I think I had a little more trouble with checks. I probably got shortchanged once or twice with cash, but there were, I probably took 10 checks that were either insufficient funds or closed accounts. And,
but that's everybody. Everybody.
But that's over all the years. I mean, that was my first.
Yeah.
I would say between 1977, when I actually started really doing it on my own and not working for other people, and 2001, I probably took $1,500 worth of checks that didn't ever clear.
Let's go back to the high school days for just a second. You say you had a job to support your car, so you obviously had to go to somebody and say, "Hey, Mr. Service Station Owner, I'm a blind guy, but I'm also a hell of a mechanic. Could you use somebody like me?" You know, what do you think he thought?
For most of my working career as a car mechanic, getting a job was extremely difficult. I could get people to let me hang around, and I could get low-paying jobs, but I could never get on the payroll making the same salary as the other folks. The usual excuses were, "Well, we'd like to pay you cash because, you know, the insurance thing or liability or, well," and it went on that way till I finally decided, you know what, you guys, I'm not going to work for less than what your other buddies are when I've got the same tooling, I've got the same knowledge, I'm doing all the same work as they are. I'm just hiding in the back corner or you know, out behind the building or whatever it is. And so when I moved here, I opened my own.
But you say that the people you worked for as a high school would pay your buddy more than they would for you. And obviously, we know that is because you were blind.
Yeah.
I mean, there's
no
question about that. That is raw discrimination. Because you were blind, they figured you couldn't do as good a job. And actually, in some areas, you probably did a better job than
I was taught by my own, by my own family.
Yeah.
And what would go on, for instance, the first job that I had, there was a gas station about six blocks from my folks' house. And I would always go there to borrow their parts washer, or to put air in a tire, or to use the air compressor to blow things off. And so after a while, they realized that, you know, here's this little kid out there fixing cars.
Yeah, working on stuff, yeah.
And then occasionally when I'd be there, some car would come in and I'd say, "Hey, that car has a broken so-and-so," because I knew what it was from hearing the noise.
Yes, sir.
And at first they would say, "Oh, yeah, right," and then they'd get into it. And pretty soon the guy who owned the place said, "You know, that little kid knows his stuff."
That's wonderful. Yeah, but
and so they would pay me $5 or $10 to hang around there and help them out a little bit.
Now, did they have a lift, or did they? How did they work on cars?
This particular place didn't have a lift.
So you were down in a pit, or you were under the car, or what?
Yeah, it had a pit.
Had a pit.
Which you drive over, and then you can walk down in and work on the car underneath it.
Yeah, which is tantamount to a lift. I mean, you had plenty of move around. You weren't laying on your back.
No.
Yeah.
But for most of my career, I was. I didn't have a lift from, 70 till 2000. No, 70 till 98.
Really? You know,
I got the last shop that I had. I said, you know, I've had enough of this laying on a creeper all my life. I'm going to buy a lift. So I did.
Well, if I worked on cars, I'd have to have one, because that's what I hated was laying. But you know, a guy, and you may already know this, you probably do. Some guy, when we do the Blind Handyman show, we talk about all kind of things, and we've talked a little bit about blind people working on automobiles. And he's a totally blind guy, and he puts a plastic bag over his head.
I lay shop rags over my face.
Yeah, because
I'm on a creeper.
He doesn't need to see anyway, so, and he doesn't want that stuff falling on his face, so he just put a grocery bag over his head. So I thought, that's an inventive. You know, I used to take the garbage out with a bag over my head if it's raining. I didn't want to get wet. I'd walk around the neighborhood with a bag over my head. Of course, people tend to think you're nuts if you do that. But so you worked at this service station as a child, and then when we got you out of high school, you graduated high school, what did you do? What did you decide to do?
Well, at that point in time, I was going to go to college and take business administration because I wanted to open a stereo store.
Okay, as in selling car stereos?
Car stereos mainly. And house stereos, but it was the focus at that time was car stereo.
Installing them, selling them?
All of it.
All of it.
Thing. And so I went to school to learn about business, and then the two buddies of mine that were going to open the store with me ended up going their separate ways to do other things.
Mm-hmm.
And I still knew the guy that I was playing with drag racing cars with, because he and I were still working on the car, of course.
Uh-huh.
And it got to a point where my college studies were suffering from my work and play.
From your work? Where you work?
My work and my play.
Oh.
And so I had to decide, at the time, I had to say to myself, all right, Jerry, you either got to go get a scholarship and continue your school, or get out of your school and go to work.
One of the two. Which one did Jerry choose?
Jerry decided that if it was going to be either school or work, I may as well work and party. Because I couldn't ever party as a kid. So
okay.
I quit the school.
Quit school, and this was without a degree, so you just had a few hours in college.
I had about 40 college hours, I think. Not very many.
This dream of opening a stereo store never came to fruition.
No.
You didn't get to do that.
Never did that.
Well, you're kind of like me. You chose occupations that were nice, but they never would make you any money, you know? I chose radio and music, neither one of which you're going to get rich doing, but you can do a lot of partying doing those.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, that was kind of my main focus at that age. So you quit college, and you did what? You decided, I'll go to work and party.
Yeah, I quit college and started going to work full-time, and what I had done there is my buddy had decided that he wanted to go into sports car racing, and of course doing that led him to playing around with Porsches, and so then he found a Porsche repair shop to work at.
Uh-huh.
And he's the guy that told his boss, hey, I know somebody who's way good with carburetors. So he called me up one day asking me if I'd want to go to work there, and so I said sure. But once again, I was on the, like, $10 a day.
Uh-huh.
And got up to 25. Ooh.
Now, you say that you were good with carburetors, and I've never taken a carburetor apart, but I've heard about them taken apart, and there are millions of little springs and pieces.
Oh, they're like a little puzzle.
And do you think your lack of sight maybe helped you there?
I think what helped me is my, I guess what I would call it, because I can't think of a word for it, is I had no fear of not getting it back together. I knew they had diagrams for everything. And so I would just start taking it apart and learning about it from that perspective. There were many times when if I knew I had a certain job coming up with a certain type of part on a car, I would see if I could get out to a wrecking yard and find a old one that was no longer useful and then take it apart and put it together and figure it out.
So that you'd be able to do this for real when it came time to do it for money.
Yeah. And then the only thing that really ever changed is after a while, when I realized that there was what they called a flat rate book, which is it's basically a book of most car-oriented jobs telling you how long the job should take.
Okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's and they still do it today. they have a book. Let's say you want to put a transmission in your 1999 Nissan Sentra.
All right.
There is a book that tells you it should take X amount of hours. And
okay.
then you apply that to your labor rate.
Yeah.
So you can tell a customer how much it should cost to fix your car.
Yeah.
And so what happens in the automotive world is the mechanics generally get paid by the job. So if you figure out how to do this job, let's say this transmission job, in 3 hours and it pays 5 hours, make 5 hours pay.
Then you made extra money.
But if you figure out how to do this transmission job in 3 days and it pays 5 hours, well, you made 5 hours pay.
Still.
So that's a function they call piecework. And most mechanics generally are expected to work get paid double the hours that they put in.
Why is that?
Well, for one thing, when tools are invented to make a job faster, oftentimes there are certain types of tools that are invented to make jobs easier. Those are money savers, and I guess they figure the way the flat rate books are worked out is the people that do those will do a job two or three times to see how fast they can get it.
Uh-huh.
And that's basically what the structure is set for. So when a guy does a job, let's say 10 times, he gets it faster and faster and faster.
Okay, and that's the figure they use? That's the time they use after the guy's done the job 10 times?
No, usually they Mitchell and Motors and Chilton's do a job two or three times.
And then they figure that's the length of time it should take you to do the job.
That's the average length of time it should take.
But a really sharp mechanic can do that job in half the time, many times.
Yeah, because there are ways to make it easier. For instance, let's say you're going to change a water pump.
Okay. Which I have done.
If after you do it three or four times, you might figure out, hey, I don't need to take the alternator off. I can just take this one bolt out. I don't need to take the front grill off. I can prop one corner of it up. So you figure out all kinds of shortcuts.
And I can still get my hands in there. I can just move the alternator aside without having to actually take it off.
Under dash work was a place where I could make a lot of money because I could do it a lot faster than...
Because you didn't have to see under the dash.
Yeah, I didn't have to crawl under. I could just reach under it.
You could sit there on the hump in the middle of the car, reach up under and do what it was ever had to be done.
Yep.
See, that's wonderful.
One of my famous ones was changing speedometers in old Porsches. They paid an hour and a half to do it.
Okay.
I took 15 minutes.
You can do it in 15 minutes.
Because I didn't have to take apart part of the steering column. I didn't have to move the turn signal controls or the choke controls or the headlight switches. I just reach up behind them, spin the two little nuts off with my fingers, unscrew the cable with a wrench that I had made. I took the end of an open-end wrench and cut it off.
And to make it shorter so you could move up in there.
Yeah.
I got you.
I never had to get down underneath it to look at it.
So you were talking to a guy, looking at his face, while your hands were under that dash, removing the speedometer.
Yeah, in fact, there was a case I still remember. My boss had said, here, you've got to change this. What happened in those cars, a lot of times the odometer would quit working.
Uh-huh.
And the odometer is the part that tells you how many miles you've gone.
Yeah.
And so the fix was to remove the whole thing and then send it to a speedometer shop, which would then replace the broken gear, clean it all up, and send it back to you.
Okay.
And they charged over an hour to do that, to do the remove and replace job. And the one I specifically remember, the 15-minute one, a guy had brought his car in, my boss said, you know, it needs a speedometer changed, and we've got a replacement one.
Yeah.
Here, and so they bring it in and park it in my bay, and I get in it and say, okay. And so the customer's standing there, and he's all, a blind mechanic, huh? Well, I guess that's okay. We started talking, of course, about 5 minutes later, I had it out, and I took it over.
But all the time you were looking at him, talking with your hands.
Yeah, I was just sitting in the car behind the steering wheel with my head turned to the left.
That's a great story, Jerry, while looking at the customer talking to him. Yeah.
And then the worst part came, the guy comes over and he gives me the parts guy comes over and he gives me the new speedometer, and he says, Jerry, what are you going to do with the hour and a half that you're supposed to take to do this job? And I said, I don't know. I'm going back to put the speedometer in. Didn't think any more of it. So I get the thing back in. It's now been 15 minutes or so. I'm asking the guy, look, is this turned level enough to suit you? You know, there's no keyway. It's a round gauge.
Okay.
You just slide it into the dash, and then you had to turn left. You know, you had to twist it like a clock, left or right, to get it.
So to make sure that the 12 or whatever it was at the top.
Yeah.
So you'd almost have to have sighted help to do that.
Well, what I could do.
What I would have done is gotten the guy to mark it with a little piece of tape.
Well, that's what I did when I took the old ones out. I marked them with it's like a center punch, but it's what they called a push punch. So when you push on it, it clicks and it makes a little bump or a little
makes a little dent. I know exactly what you're talking about.
And but the new ones that I got to replace that old one weren't marked like that. So when I wasn't putting the customer's original part back in, I'd need a little help.
Yeah. So you asked the customer. Now is this level for you? Is this how you want this?
Yeah.
And he said, well, yeah, that looks good to me.
You know, it's, I need to turn a little more this way. Oh, there you go, and that's fine. And then put the
nuts on.
Put the nuts on and plug the light bulb in and put the cable on and thank you very much. Have a good day. And out you go. So here he goes. It's been 15 or 20 minutes. He gets up to pay for his car, and they're charging him for an hour and a half of work.
Did they? Did they make it stick?
Usually.
Yeah.
You know, and then after a while, what they would try and do is those kinds of jobs where they knew, and they would do this for all the mechanics, when they knew that a mechanic was beating flat rate by a lot, they would try and get the customer to leave the car. Pick it up later in the day.
That's a nice blind story. I tell you what, let's do. We've got you working on cars and doing things, but you don't do that today, so that's what we want to get into. We've got about 17, 18 minutes left. Let's take a little quick break and come back and talk about coffee. How about that?
All right.
Good deal.
A website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now with this week's Blind Sight, here's Don Shaw.
Hi there. You know, here on the Blind Sight segment of the Blind Like Me show, you know, we want to cover all types and all kinds of websites here. If you have your own website that you'd like us to talk a little bit about, send a link to that site. Send it here to the Blind Like Me show, and I'll go and take a look at it and talk a little bit about it. Let's pass on the word to some other folks, some other listeners here to the show. This week, I want to talk a little bit about a site called Fun with Tubes. It belongs to Max Robinson, a member of the Blind Handyman list. And this is a really great site. It's the site you need to go and visit if you're interested in electronics, antique electronics, amplifiers, tube radios and stereos of all kinds. If you're interested in tube amplifiers, remember the old tube hi-fi systems. Max has got all different kinds of projects that he's written about there, and we'll show you how to do on the site. Everything from building a crystal radio set, well, I can remember those from the old days, to power supplies. If you need a power supply for your bench, he'll tell you how to make one. He's just a wealth of knowledge there for electronics. Heck, he'll even show you how to build an amplifier. He'll even show you how to do some breadboarding. If you want to go and check that out, go and check out Fun with Tubes. www.funwithtubes, funwithtubes.com. Take a look at them. You never know what kind of projects you might find to do. Until next time, I'm Don Shaw. Keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sights.
I loved him once, but that was long ago.
Segment 3 of our show we call Blind Like Me. We're visiting with Jerry Leary from Boulder, Colorado. Incidentally, what is the temperature there today in Boulder on this, the 3rd of October?
Oh, I bet it's in the low 60s now. Getting up, it probably will hit 70-ish.
Oh, man, just a heat wave there, huh?
I've got the back door open with the doggy door.
Yeah.
We have a doggy door and a screen door.
Uh-huh. Now, I seem like I read somewhere that you had been interested in coffee all your life. Is that right or wrong? Or?
Well, pretty much. Since my early teenagehood, I'd always liked coffee. And in the early 90s, I went with a friend to San Francisco, and I went into a restaurant that I was sitting down eating breakfast at, and I heard this noise that was like a rock polisher.
Yeah.
I asked the waiter what that was. Because my friend said, I don't know, it's some big machine.
Big machine.
So I asked the waiter what the noise was, and he said, oh, that's my coffee roaster. I roast coffee beans here on site. And come over here, and I'll show it to you and tell you how it all goes.
Uh-huh.
And so he talked me through a roast, and he had all the audio clues, like, now you can hear the beans. They're getting, see how it's getting quiet?
Yeah.
That's because they are... they're softening up, and they're not as hard. They're expanding. And he just went through the whole process like that and telling me about, here how they're cracking now. This is what they're doing, and then they'll stop, and then they'll do it again. And so that just got me very interested because I thought, gosh, that's something I could do.
That's something that gave you enough audio clues that you could do it.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
And so... of course, I wanted to do that, and in the end of 2001, I had decided I wanted to close my shop because I had worked on cars long enough.
So you did that up until 2000, till 2001, you were still working on cars?
Yep.
Even with the fact that we no longer have carburetors and they're all fuel-injected, you kept up with the technology and did that?
Most of it.
I didn't realize that. I thought you'd quit that a long time ago.
No, there were a few things. The biggest problem in the automotive industry now is that I can't read...
the computer.
Diagnostic machine.
Yeah, you can't see that. And that's what everybody uses.
Yep. That's what they all use. Or in the cars themselves, there are things you can do to get the car to tell you certain diagnostic codes.
Oh, yeah.
And you can't watch the lights flash.
And there'd be no way, since the different, you might figure out how to read one computer, but there'd be no way with all the different cars that you could get a screen reader to do that. There'd just be no way.
No. And see, what they usually do is there are sequences you can do and little jumpers you can hook up, and then there's a light on the dash that'll flash in sequence to print out a number. Like it'll flash twice, stop for half a second, and then flash three times, which means it's code number 23.
And so you go look that up?
And you look that up, and you replace that part. And most of the time it's okay, and sometimes it's, gee, it still does that. Now we have to run the diagnostic.
I've got a truck that is a Tahoe that is missing and has been. We've had it in four or five times, and they've replaced fuel injectors on cylinders 2 and 7 and done this, put a new throttle body on it, done several. They still haven't figured it out. But the diagnostic, they're trying to tell me now I got bad gas. If I do, I've had it for 6 months. Anyway, so that kind of got you out of working on cars. I guess you saw the handwriting on the wall, right?
Well, I saw the handwriting on the wall, but I was just bored. I'd done it for too long. I was losing interest, and I just didn't want to do it anymore.
And so you decided to do what? You decided to open a...
What I decided to do is I wanted to get a job roasting coffee.
Okay.
And, of course, once again, I ran into the vision problem. Everyone said, well, you can't do it if you can't see because you got to tell what color the beans are.
Wrong.
And so after hearing that about 20 times or so and going around the circle again and keep talking to people and keep getting the same answer, I said, well, I know there's got to be a way because this one particular guy talked me through the whole process. Now, I did try and go to work for that guy. But he sold the business before I got it together to move out there.
Are there people who make a living as coffee roasters?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, tell me about that. I didn't know. I wasn't aware of that.
Well, for instance, a good coffee shop can go through a couple hundred pounds a week.
Okay.
Of both serving coffee and selling coffee. And so what a lot of, not, well, I don't know what percentage, but what guys are doing these days is buying roasters and buying raw beans and roasting their own coffee.
This is in a commercial shop,
commercial shop,
like a latte place or what is the big one that's everywhere?
Well,
Starbucks.
Starbucks started that way.
Do Starbucks actually roast coffee on site?
Not in all their small shops. No,
okay.
Not anymore. But they started with one small coffee shop and a 25-pound roaster.
Roasting beans themselves.
Yep.
And then brewing coffee from the beans.
Yep.
They roasted.
Yep. And then there are companies, for instance, there's a company called Javalia.
Uh-huh.
Which sells mail order. And they only sell beans. They don't have a coffee shop. But they roast their own. I don't know where they're located, but that's just one example.
That you can probably buy on the Internet.
You buy them on the Internet. You can buy them mail order. They send catalogs to you.
Okay, so you went around to several people, and no one would give Blind Jerry a job as a coffee roaster.
Nope, they didn't want to train me.
Okay.
And so at the beginning, end of last year, I did find a guy who was willing to let me hang around and watch him roast, but he didn't need a roaster. He was a small operation, and he roasted about two nights a week for about 2 or 3 hours a night. And he said, you know, I just can't put you to work. I don't make enough money.
But I'd be glad to help you get trained.
But, you know, you can hang around all you want and watch, and so I did for a little while, and I started asking him where he got his training, and he said, oh, there's a place out in the West Coast called the San Francisco Coffee Training Institute. It's part of the West Coast Specialty Coffee Company, which is where I buy my beans.
Uh-huh.
So I called those guys.
And
they said, well, I haven't ever trained a blind guy before, but I know a blind guy who's a roaster. And you're more than welcome to take the class. You'll have to tell me what help you need, but I'm willing to give it a whirl.
But he said, I know a blind guy that's a roaster.
Yeah.
There's nothing the man could have said that would have been that could have made you any happier, right?
Oh man, no, I was already in seventh heaven.
Oh yeah. I'm willing to train you and I know a blind guy who's a roaster, come on. Yeah, very good. So we went.
I went to the school and took the class and basically, the help that they needed to give me was to read the thermometer for me and show me. In other words, we ran several roasts, lighter and darker, to see if I could feel the difference in the beans or hear mm-hmm. the difference in their sound. And I kind of got it figured out. So when I got out of there, I came back home and I tried again to get a job, and I couldn't do it. And finally in March, I said, well, you know, I've got about $10,000 left in my life. I can either, you know, milk it for another year, except I don't want to go back into doing cars, so forget that. So I think I'll just buy a roaster and set it up and
see what I can do.
Start a company and do it.
Yeah. Let me just go back just a second. They had to read the thermometer to you to tell you whether you were getting these beans dark or light or what.
Yes.
Okay, well, we should have a thermometer that we should. What temperatures are we talking about here?
Well, generally, when you complete a roast of coffee, you want. Now, it depends on the type of bean, but you pull them out anywhere from 375 to 450 degrees.
Okay. Well, you know, we have all kinds of talking thermometers now. We don't have one that you can put in the meatloaf yet and tell the temperature of that, but I don't see why we don't.
Well, there's a story around that. Actually, we do.
Do we?
We do.
Okay.
In one of my other hobbies is amateur radio.
Okay.
And there is an organization called Handy Hams, which is an organization that helps the disabled or physically, mentally challenged in amateur radio troubles. And so they make different adaptive devices for people. Like they make a device that people who are upper body paraplegics can use their lips to send Morse code.
Okay.
They make an audio device so that blind people can properly adjust transmitters. And one of the things they do is they've got a publication that comes out a couple times a year called Handy Ham's World. And in it, there are a couple of advertisements for adaptive devices. And one of these magazines was playing on my cassette machine at the end of February.
Of this year?
Of this year. And it was talking about a meter, a talking multimeter. A multimeter is a meter that measures voltages and currents.
Yeah, I understand.
But it also had two connectors for reading K-type thermocouples. And a K-type thermocouple, well, there's several different types of thermocouple, and all they are is a little metal device that's got wires coming out of one end of it, and you expose this device to heat or cold, and it changes its resistance. And then the meter converts that resistance to degrees in Fahrenheit or centigrade.
Okay.
And I said to myself, wow, well, a thermocouple, those can go in hot places. I could put one of those in a coffee roaster. So I called the company whose roasters I like.
Yeah.
And started asking them how their thermometers work. And they told me, and basically it was, there's a hole in the back of the machine, we push a thermocouple through it, we tighten a set screw, and that goes up to the gauge on the front of the machine that tells you the temperature.
So bingo. Here we go.
I said, okay, what kind of thermocouple do you use? Well, it was a different one, but since I wasn't going to use their thermometer, it didn't matter.
Yeah.
So I said to myself, all right, I bought the smallest roaster they made because that was all the money I had, which is a quarter-pound roaster. And I called this other company that makes this multimeter, which was called Omega Engineering.
Now, this was just February of this year.
Yeah.
Whoa, okay.
So they said, yeah, we'll send you a meter, and what kind of thermocouple do you want? How long do you want it? So I told them. And they sent me all the parts, and then I bought the roaster. I got it home. I took the old thermocouple out, and I laid the two down on a bench, and I started bending the new one till it looked almost like the old one, and put it in the machine and turned it on and plugged the meter in, and there we go.
And so you can now tell the temperature of roasting coffee beans.
Yep.
That is knocked out. That's another great story. And this still doesn't give me a meatloaf thermometer.
Well, no, not yet. But the thing is, I can now take a thermocouple. I could get them to make me one with a point on it.
Yep.
And then I could plug it into this meter and jam it into the
into the ham. Or the, yeah, and we'd know, wouldn't we?
Yep.
So we're closer.
In fact, my oven that I have at my home has a touchpad to work it. So when I push the little button to increase the temperature, it's one of these, if you tap it, it moves 5 degrees, and if you hold it, it moves more.
Yeah.
Well, the difference between tapping and holding is not very much, so sometimes I tap it and it goes 10 or 15 degrees.
It doesn't make a beep every time it moves 5 degrees.
No, it makes a beep every time you touch it.
Hmm. So, but it may move 10 degrees when you touch it.
Yeah.
Oh, not good.
And so I bought another probe that I can just stick in the oven door and let the wires hang out the door and see what temperature my oven's really at.
Surely somebody will have, because like I said, we have the, you know, I got it by the head of my bed. I can tell you the temperature inside and outside. So if it'll read that, why no one has made yet one that'll read up to 500 degrees?
Probably because we just haven't bothered the right people.
So surely that's coming. But you, on your roaster, you can roast beans, and you can tell what temperature they're roasting at, and you know when they're dark or when they're light, and so you know you've got that problem is solved.
That problem is solved.
That problem is solved.
And then to weigh them, there's a scale that is a talking food scale.
Oh, yeah, we've got those.
And, the only problem with them is the one I have, which has a British voice to it, will measure in either half-ounce increments or 5-gram increments.
Oh, so you have to convert.
So you can't get a real exact measurement. You can get within 5 grams of what you want to be.
You know? There's always something in there. It's always something.
That's close enough.
That's close enough, yes.
I can keep pouring, for instance, the bags of coffee that I make are about a quarter pound because that's all my roaster roast. And I can pour into the bag till it hits about 115 grams or so, which is around a quarter pound. I can't get it exactly, but I can get it a couple grams over and get to 115 and call
there
it
you
good.
Are. Now, with this roaster, you don't have a commercial store, so you're selling coffee to the general public, is that right?
Yes.
Do you have an internet site?
I do have the beginnings of an internet site, which is www.theunseenbean.com.
www.theunseenbean.com.
.com. It's got the in it, so you have to put theunseenbean.
So you have to put it all.
And
theunseenbean.com. .org. What?
.com.
.com. Okay, what's there?
And what's there is a little bit of description about what I do, a little bit of a description of the coffee, and then my contact information, which is email, address, and phone number.
Okay.
I don't have the ordering form worked out yet.
But you will have.
But I will.
Okay.
It's not real cheap to do internet work unless you know HTML yourself, and I don't. So,
you know, there's some blind guy out there who does.
Oh, I know.
If we can find him, he might be willing to take a pound of fresh coffee to fix you up. There's some blind guy out there who knows exactly what you need to know, and we need to find him and get him in touch with you.